show. Thanks for tuning in on this Friday, October the 11th. It is 8 a.m. on the East Coast. This is your 5 a.m. West Coast wake-up call and all time zones in between. Welcome into the show. It is Daniel Workman. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you're having a great Friday. I hope you have a great weekend. Hope you've had a great week. Tonight, the U.S. take on Cuba. And we'll see what's going on. I don't know that at this point there's anything to be quote unquote excited about, but we will see. We are in the middle of an international break, and you know, no club soccer this weekend. And so kind of a, you know, slow weekend in terms of some news, any kind of updates. One of the things that I did see was, yesterday on ESPN, why Dest should represent Netherlands, not the U.S. men's national team. That's something we've been talking about here on the show, for about a week or so, because to anyone that is looking at it from a footballing perspective, opportunity perspective, etc., if Dest has a legitimate shot, it's a no-brainer move. The only reason why I would suggest the U.S. men's national team is, number one, now if your heart's just completely set on the U.S. men's national team, that's one thing, right? It's hard to argue with the heart. Secondly, if you don't feel like you're going to get a legitimate shot with the Netherlands, then yeah, I mean, that makes sense as to why you would look at the U.S. national team. Other than that, everything is stacked in favor of the Netherlands. And, you know, as much as we would, you know, love to fancy that the U.S. men's national team is a dream destination, it's not. And anyone, you know, not wearing rose colored glasses, would know that. Yesterday also was the 2 year anniversary of the colossal failure at Trinidad and Tobago in World Cup 2018 qualifying that happened on October the 10th, 2017. And the question then begs, what has happened since? Where is the progress? Where are the reforms? Where are the changes, the new processes, the new personnel, all of those things to change the trajectory and the path of the U.S. men's national team, the program at large, the national team on a senior level, more specifically. But overall, I mean, we failed to qualify for the last two Olympics on the men's side. Where is progress? Where is a tangible plan that we can see, hey, these things are not only going to get better, but they are getting better? One of the things that I look at over the last 2 years is I think we have wasted an opportunity. And here's what I mean by that. The reason why I would use the word wasted is for a variety of reasons. Number one, the failure was an opportunity to hit the reset button, to do a deep, deep internal introspective look at who we are as a country, as a federation on a macro level. Now, I think a lot of the national members, the voting members of the National Council of U.S. Soccer, I think a lot of them did. I saw that traveling the country, meeting people, talking to people, working with Eric Winalda when he was running for president of U.S. Soccer. And so I heard a lot of that feedback, that there were a lot of people that said, hey, let's hit the reset button here. Let's find a way to get this right, to do it better. We should not be failing to qualify for the World Cup. We haven't taken that opportunity. Due to the rules of U.S. soccer, the election rules of U.S. soccer, status quo remained. Carlos Cordero, the reigning vice president, a member of the board for 10 years, who was part of all of the issues, assumed power as president. The following year, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, member of the Athlete Council that famously partnered with Carlos Cordero and in the status quo to vote in Carlos Cordero as president. She assumes the throne as vice president in an uncontested election. So in the 2 years, just on a federation level, haven't seen a lot of progress. Other areas where I feel like it was wasted is, even if we didn't change things at a federation level, which that's where the buck stops. That's the ultimate level of accountability and leadership. Every organization's got that layer, has got that ending point of where accountability ultimately resides with. And that is usually with the whatever the executive office or branch of an organization is. That's where the buck should stop. So where does the ultimate oversight and accountability layer or level or position for an organization? That's where you should look. That's why on a macro level, we have to look at the federation. They are ultimately the ones responsible. When you go down that org chart, you start looking at the other things. Now you're looking at, for example, another wasted opportunity, how we handled the coaching issue after the failure. We don't immediately sack Bruce Arena, but eventually, weeks later, we finally part ways with Bruce Arena. But we allow his assistant to become really kind of a caretaker, interim manager for a year to try to let him oversee the program, hoping that the angst of the public would die a little bit so that we could put the COO's brother, a coach in Major League Soccer at the time, install him as head coach of the U.S. men's national team. So the worst kept secret in American soccer finally happened a year later with the hiring of Greg Berhalter. Now, this has nothing to do with at that time of whether or not Greg Berhalter was the right candidate, whether he's the right coach, whether he was qualified or good enough for the position. We're just looking at the process here, right? We don't immediately sack the coach. We don't follow that up with progress. We take the next year off and just let the program sit in limbo. All the while, instead of looking forward and trying to bring in young talent, because the federation didn't have a plan, they didn't have an action plan, we waste that year in an interim caretaker status, finally bringing in a year later Greg Berhalter. And the results under Greg Berhalter have not been promising. The team doesn't look good. Player selections, who's coming into camp, head scratchers a lot of times. It just looks like the program's going nowhere fast. When you look back over what's happened in the last 2 years, I think you can make the argument, not only have we not made progress, I think you can make the argument on the men's side of the ledger, we've actually gone backwards or fallen further behind at the very least, because other countries are getting better. Mexico's better now than they were 2 years ago. And that's an issue for us. We're both in CONCACAF. Our sponsor this half hour is Ductic Brand, D-U-K-T-I-G brand.com. They are the makers of some really cool products. We talk about them every day on this show. And one of those that I want to highlight today is their waterproof paper. If you've ever laid a notebook on the ground in training and then pick it up, you know, because you were showing someone something or, you know, you wanted to use both hands to kind of demonstrate, and then you go pick up your notebook and it's like soaking wet from the dew. It doesn't even have to be raining. It's a real bummer. Well, DuckTick brand has solved that issue for you with their waterproof paper in some of their notebooks. Check them out at DuckTickBrand.com and use promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of your next order. We'll be right back with Aaron West. Show. We are excited to have joining us Aaron West. He is the host of BR Football's Out Here. And we are excited to have you, Aaron. How are you this morning?
I'm good, man. I'm a little bit sick, but I'm good. Good to be here. Thank you guys for having me.
Well, look, thanks for showing up sick. If you were my kids, they might be like calling in sick and Dad, I need to just stay in bed. But we appreciate you spending some time with us this morning. Before we kind of get into kind of what you're doing right now as host of BR's Out Here, give us a little bit of background about you. How did you originally, you know, get connected to the game itself, and give us a little bit of kind of, you know, personal background on you and your love for the game?
Yeah. I'll make a very, very long story short. I was born and raised in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. That's from most people from the U.S. They know that as like basketball country. Both of my parents went to UNC. My dad was actually a track coach. He was the first black head coach in the ACC at UNC. So I had no soccer background, but when I was three, my mom's best friend introduced us to the sport, and I just fell in love. Like, that was it for me. It was the sport for me. So I started playing. My brother's 3 years older. I started playing on his team because there was no organized soccer at three. So I'd just go and like kick around and play with his team. Started to organize, ended up going. I was actually homeschooled all through high school into college, but ended up playing club soccer in the Chapel Hill Raleigh area. Got a partial scholarship to go play for Davidson College. Played all 4 years there. And then I will say like the most minimal career, if you can call it that, afterwards. Tried to play for a couple different clubs and was just constantly injured. Got one contract offer that was so small it like I almost laughed, but it was an offer, but it just, with the injuries and the way that I saw my career going, it didn't feel worth it to continue to try and be a professional soccer player and just be hurt all the time and not make any money. So When I was around 20, right out of college, I was still trying to play and trying to figure it out. So I started working for an education outreach company. And from there, started just kind of blogging on the side. And over the next few years, I worked in social media and just kind of freelancing, trying to figure out my life. Just was really heavy on social media, especially Twitter, in the soccer sphere, writing, blogging. I picked up a couple freelance gigs working here and there. And then kind of my big break, so to speak, was in 2016, when I got the offer to go write for Fox Sports out in LA. So I was there for a little under a year and a half as a writer, just covering mainly European soccer, but basically everything in the soccer world for Fox Sports. And then when they made the big pivot, they were the first major company to make the pivot from, completely pivot away from written content to video. Thank you, Facebook, for your inflated views. but when that happened, I left Copa and actually myself pivoted to, I left Fox and pivoted to video, and started my kind of on camera career at Copa 90. And I went there with a view to kind of run their social media, revamp their social media, their voice on social media, do some on camera and do a good bit of writing for docs, explainers, things like that. And it morphed into a lot of on camera and then like almost all on camera. And then I stepped away from the social, still did some writing. So it was just mainly on camera. And then Copa actually ended up cutting their US content team at the beginning of 2019. And from there, I just decided to stay freelance for a while. Did the Women's World Cup, a few other things, a few other projects that I really, really enjoyed. And then got the opportunity to cover Champions League with BR Football, which is what I'm doing now. That's the show that I'm hosting with them called Out Here. So that was a long, short version of how I got to where I am today.
Well, first off, as a Duke basketball fan, I'm sorry that you grew up in such a downtrodden and horrible home life there as a Tar Heel. It's like people growing up as Yankee fans. It's just a terrible way to grow up. So I want to kind of jump back in your story for a second. Obviously, North Carolina, is famous on their women's side with the college soccer program, but you know their men's soccer has been no slouch, and Duke has a pretty good program as well. You got a lot of good college soccer programs there in the ACC. Growing up in the area, obviously your dad, being on the faculty at UNC, What was the environment like around growing up in terms of soccer in the Triangle of North Carolina? Is it something that's followed closely by the locals? Is it just something in the background? You know, when you were growing up, what was the conversations like surrounding, say the UNCs and the Dukes and the, Wake Forest, the NC States and the other ACC schools in terms of college soccer?
Yeah, man, it was a really, really cool time to come up because soccer wasn't really huge around the rest of the country, but it was pretty big in the Triangle. We had a lot of good players growing up in that area, and especially being from Chapel Hill, being like women's soccer was king, but like you said, the men's soccer team was actually really, really good when I was coming up as well. So it was kind of like a golden age. We lived close enough and we were on campus all the time. So I would go out and kick around with some of the women's players, with some, depending on who was out there. Like we would just go out to the training fields and just kick around. I remember when I was young, I used to go out and like shoot on Siri Mullenix, who played for UNC, played for the national team. And that was like when I was like 10 years old. So it was an amazing, like a really, really cool experience being in that area because it was such a kind of soccer cauldron. And especially in that time, I'm 33 years old, like it was not a huge sport in the U.S. Like even outside of kind of like directly in Chapel Hill or in Raleigh, like people would see me kicking a soccer ball and be like, what are you doing? Like, why aren't you playing basketball or football or baseball? But specifically in Chapel Hill and in that kind of triangle area, it was a really cool time to come up loving the game.
Again, for the audience, we feel for Aaron and having to grow up in Chapel Hill in that horrible shade of blue, but somebody had to do it. I always mess with, people who went to North Carolina or are North Carolina fans, because what's a rivalry if you can't have a little fun with it? So you come up, you grew up, as you described, in kind of a golden era and also just geographically in a good spot, you know, for the game, had access to the game and, you know, was kind of a hot pocket, you could say, for development, for players, interest, etc. And you make it to Davidson. One of the first questions I would have for you with your playing career was one of your goals and ambitions to, when you got out of college, was to play professionally, or was that something that, you know, you thought about later on, like as college was coming to a close, or growing up, was there this idea of like, hey, I'd like to see if I could make it as a pro?
Yeah, it was extremely strong when I was younger and kind of waned when I got into college, and both realized that I was extremely injury prone. Number two, I kind of fell out of love with the playing experience a little bit while I was in college. It was just, college is a tough grind. It's too many games in too short of a period. You don't get to train a ton. It's like a weird system. I hated the running sub. So the actual college soccer experience itself kind of soured me on the game a little bit at that time. I still very strongly wanted to play. And then kind of as I got towards the tail end of my career and realized that I was injury prone, there were a lot of really, really good players out there that I wouldn't make any money. and then just kind of the combination of not enjoying training, falling out of love with the experience, my kind of determination to be a pro, I wouldn't say it was the strongest from the start. Like I definitely had a chance and thought I would be in MLS possibly. And then as I got into it, through college, I was just like, I don't love this playing as much as I used to. This is I kind of got burned out during college. And then after college was when I really, really rediscovered my love for the game and was like, should I continue to try and grind? And like there, I have a few friends or teammates that I played with, some of whom were way better, some of whom weren't as talented, but it's really at that level. It's like, how much do you want to be a pro? And I realized I didn't want to be a pro that badly. Like I really just didn't want to do it. Like it's a crazy grind and I didn't want to put myself through that to just call myself a pro soccer player and be on a team and not start my professional development. I kind of saw that even if I did become a pro, it probably wouldn't be like a decade long thing. It wouldn't be 15 years. I would have to get a job eventually. So I kind of cut out the pain and suffering of grinding to be a pro and said, you know what? This maybe isn't for me. I'm going to try and get a real job.
So your pro opportunities, you mentioned, the pay wasn't great. What kind of a ballpark of pay were you looking at in terms of opportunities? Cause I think a lot of people, you know, Major League Soccer, it has come, from where it started in the 90s to where it is today, certainly is on better footing than what it was back then. But a lot of kids growing up today, they have a view of Champions League, of the Barcelonas, Real Madrid's, Liverpool's, Manchester United, so on and so forth. And, you know, they if they're thinking about, dreaming about, desiring to play pro football, that's usually kind of where they go when you talk to most kids in the U.S. But the realities of the American pro opportunities are not anywhere near the level of what you see over in Europe. So what are some of those realities that you came into, to face when you were at least entertaining the idea of a pro playing career? Do you have a ballpark range of kind of some of those opportunities you had?
Yeah, we're talking like, an offer for a USL team of like $800 a month with no housing, and you're training every day and playing. So you almost can't even get like a regular job. So you can't afford to live. You have to play all the time and maybe get like a night job. So I was like, I don't want to do that.
So in the it becomes very tough, right, at that point to kind of really say I'm going to go all in when at $800 a month, it's almost, you know, impossible. You're obviously living below the poverty line as defined by the U.S. government at that point.
And for me, it was like one of those things. I didn't feel it was worth it to call myself a pro soccer player, to go through training every day, which I didn't enjoy. And I realized I just like to play, pick up playing games and things like that. I just love to have the ball at my feet, but I hated training. And that combination of all of it, especially with not being paid anything and just my body being broken constantly, I was just like, it's not worth it. It's really just not worth it for me.
What was that like for you in terms of coming to the realization, you know, for yourself, like, I don't know that I love this as much as maybe I thought I would, or, you know, just to kind of go and say, hey, look, I'm just going to look myself in the mirror and go, this isn't for me. What was that like for you? Was that a short process? Was there kind of a dramatic moment, or was it just kind of over time? You just kind of was like, you know what? Like, this isn't for me. Like, how was that process for you? Cause I think, you know, a lot of people, you grow up with certain goals or ambitions, and then, you know, you like, for example, you talk to a kid and you'll hear a kid say, I want to be a policeman when I grow up. But then, you know, you start growing up and you're like, I'm not going to be a policeman. Right. So for you going, hey, I want to be a pro soccer player. You mentioned the older you got, it started to kind of wane, and then college soccer really put a damper on some things as well in terms of your passion and love level for things. In terms of not enjoying the training and all of those things, did that start because of college and then kind of carried on, or were you just one of those players that just never really enjoyed training? And like, what was that process like for you, that realization process of, man, pro soccer and being a pro soccer player is just not for me?
Yeah, I think it mainly started in college because I was always relatively injury prone, but the college experience just kind of like packaged or like put all that into a tiny box and like really, really exacerbated it with the short season, with the pace and like the way that the college game is with running subs, or at least was. It's gotten better in recent years. It's more of a measured, like the players, the coaches don't just sub two, three times a half. It's more of a actual like measured game where there's possession and things like that. And it just, it started to wane in college, frankly, because for all the reasons that a lot of people start to lose their motivation for high level sports in college. Often it's, I saw the social life. I was very like my first freshman year, I literally didn't do anything. I was like, I would hang out, but like, I didn't really go out. I just wanted to be a footballer. And then you get injured, and then I didn't like the training. I wasn't super happy with the playing experience. I started to just see that there were more things than about the game, than just playing it. I started to enjoy more of learning more about the actual world of football. I had always been obsessed with reading about the game and researching about it. And as I got into college, it just shifted more into, hey man, this playing experience is kind of sucks right now sometimes. and it kind of just during college a little bit sapped my love for the actual playing part of the game, but the other sides of it grew stronger, which is partly why right out of college, I kind of felt like I was twiddling my thumbs, and I felt like I had something to say about the game and couldn't really figure out what that needed to be. So a friend of mine encouraged me to just start a blog and start writing my thoughts down. And that was really when I like kind of saw the light and was like, oh, this is the part of the game that I really, really love. Like, I love to play pickup. I love to just go out with the ball on my own. I hate going to training. I don't really like being outside that much. I don't like being injured constantly. I don't like playing in the cold. It was like all of these little things that I started to figure out, especially when I got into college. I was injured for long periods. I tore my groin. When I was 15, I like cracked a vertebra in my back. I tore literally every muscle possible in college. I tore my groin. I tore my hamstring. I tore my quads. I tore my labrum. I had a couple different surgeries. And so just all the downtime, and then just being around people in college and having great conversations and learning and kind of honing the mental side of who I was as a person and emotional side kind of pushed me a little bit away from thinking that playing professionally was the end all be all, which is what I thought for so, so long. And then just as I got a little bit older and realized that this may be, there was kind of a crossroads. It's like, I could keep grinding and try. Like, it was around my junior year. I was like, I just come off another surgery. And I was like, I could keep grinding and try to do this legitimately. And I could probably have a decent career. I could have probably, if I had tried to put my head down and just fight through the injuries, I would have probably been a USL player for 2 or 3 years. And this is all very hypothetical and like the highest optimistic part. I could have played for 2 or 3 years, I think, in USL and maybe gotten a shot in MLS. Maybe. But for me at the time, when I thought about what that meant and I saw that the minimum salaries in MLS were like $30,000, I was like, I'm going to grind for 3 years and make like $10,000 a year to then make $30,000 a year and then still be injured probably. So it just seemed logical to me, like, hey, man, you're really not that good. Why don't you just get a real job?
So how much do you think the realities of the low salaries in the American professional game in those low salaries still exist today, especially relative to, the NBA or the NFL or Major League Baseball? If you're a kid growing up and you want to be a pro soccer player and play professionally in the U.S., like you just talked about, I mean, you might grind for 2 or 3 years making, really kind of part-time pay, and then you're hoping to, maybe make, if you get to MLS, you can get a league minimum. I think it's up now around 50, 60 grand a year. Still nowhere near the levels of a kid who may grow up saying, hey, I want to play in the NBA kind of thing. How much do you think that has an effect on some really good players in this country quitting the game just because they don't see a pathway? They don't see it being a realistic opportunity, and therefore not only is our professional level of soccer in terms of domestic players not being as good a quality as it could be because we're losing players for that, but even possibly down the road even affecting like our national team. How much do you think that the limitations of financial opportunity is having a negative or adverse effect on our player pool?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two trains of thought there. It's like people like me, who would never have played for the national team anyway, they might be discouraged by the pay. But to be fair, most players who are going to play at the highest levels, they're not super motivated by the pay anyway. They're just motivated by the love of the game, for training, for being out there literally every day. And I wasn't one of those people. I was talented and I worked hard, but for me to be a pro, it would have taken like an extra effort on my part just because of my personality. And part of that was that I was driven by, I wanted to make good money. I would never wanted to be rich, but I at least wanted to be able to live on my salary. And so I think for people kind of like me, that is a big deterrent. But honestly, I think one of the biggest issues is that for a kid, say, if you're a kid who grows up in a economically unstable situation, say you grew up kind of poor and you want to be a pro athlete and you want to be a pro athlete in this country, and you want to get out of a situation where you have no money, you're immediately going to look at basketball, football, baseball, maybe even hockey. because they make good money. If you want to get out of a financial situation, you're not going to play soccer in this country because you're middle class, basically. Like, no one really wants to come from being poor to just middle class unless they're working a regular job. People play sports because it's fun, but also because you can get yourself out of a really extraordinarily poor financial situation and become an instant millionaire. You can do that with basketball. You can do that with football. You can do that with baseball. You cannot do that with soccer in this country right now. And I think that actually is a deterrent for some people picking up the sport at the lower levels who could be special at this game.
Yeah, I agree. I'm from an area where we've seen some of the, poorest of poor find their way out of their situations into college, in playing American football and into the NFL, and incredible players, incredible talents, but that was their reality. It was like, this is my way out. Like, I have to find a way out. I mean, there's a player right now in the NBA, DeMarcus Cousins, who's from where I am from. And, that was, his pathway was getting out, getting to Kentucky, and then getting to the NBA. So, I agree. I think that is
Alabama.
Yeah, man. Right on the Gulf, 2 hours east of New Orleans. So we're right in the hotbed heart of SEC country. And so like my high school is, we put like six players in the NFL which, we shouldn't get one because, the suburb where I grew up is a town of like 25,000 people. So we shouldn't be putting one player in the NFL, much less six. But it's the water; it's in the water here. as everyone knows, Alabama fans are, you can argue around the country, but you're wrong. I'll just tell you, you're wrong. I live here. I deal with these people. They are the most ardent, craziest fanatics of a college football team that exists in the country. So all of you Ohio State fans and Michigan fans and everyone else, you can think that you love your team as much as they do. And I've heard others be delusional and think that, but it's just not true. You come here and live and you'll understand. It's the only way I can explain it to people. The passion level here is just insane. And, it's a reality of kids growing up here, but for them, there is a way out in football or in the case of like DeMarcus, with basketball, and others who have made it in baseball. So, soccer's not really, a big, big thing here. I mean, our biggest export, state of Alabama wise, in terms of soccer is going to be Chris Richards, but he had to leave the state in order to even find a pathway out, in going to Houston as a kid and living away from his parents and then making it into the FC Dallas Academy and before finding his way to Bayern Munich. So, even then his pathway, to try to make it to a pro, started even beyond before, even looking at college and how do I make it domestically. He had to figure out how to make it domestically just to get scouted. So, right. There's just so many realities facing kids. These are areas for me, it's something I talk about every day on the show for me, where I just feel like there's so many things we could do to make it better. And a lot of that has to do with just creating an environment and a system and structure that provides more opportunity and access, because I really, feel like there's a lot of kids, and I've seen it with, my brother-in-law has been an inner city, varsity soccer coach for years. And I've seen kids who, it's like, you look at them like, man, if you only had a chance, right. And it's just the sad reality. Like if you had a chance, And it's kind of depressing at times, but it also, drives me to kind of, try to make a difference in whatever way I can. And this show is actually, you know, part of that. And, so with you, I want to get back to you. The transition from playing, covering the game, and really kind of saying, hey, I have something to say here. I have a voice. You know, when you were doing that, how long did it take you to kind of find your voice, like find how you wanted to cover the game, talk about the game, et cetera?
It's honestly just been a developing and evolving process throughout. I started out kind of just blogging mainly about Juventus, who I loved, and just the game at large. Just anything I would think about, I would just kind of write down. And I would be on Twitter just constantly. Just Twitter I gravitated to because I grew up a Juventus fan. I picked them when I was 12, and it was as an English speaking kid from the South, especially a black kid, like there were no Juventus fans around. There was no one that I could talk to regularly. So gravitating to the internet and Twitter specifically was like the biggest thing in the world for me. It was amazing. I found my whole community of fans. So just being on Twitter and occasionally blogging, I started to find my voice. I started to realize that I would say things that I thought were obvious, and then people would respond like, oh, I didn't see that. And after this happening a few different times, I was like, okay, so I do have a perspective that people don't necessarily have. And just kind of tried to, I was just in the Twitter world, in the internet world, just kind of giving my opinions, engaging in dialogue. And it just kind of progressed to the point where I was able to get a couple different freelance writing gigs. And to be fair, it has just constantly evolved. I've written long, serious tactical pieces. I've written pieces about race in the game. I've written short blog posts about goals. I've written joke posts. Like, I've written and done all kinds of things, but I think kind of the on-camera piece is really where it opened up, because people are visual. They don't read nearly as much. My running like joke when I wrote for Fox was like, did you read the headline, or did you read the whole piece, or did you just get angry at the headline? It's a thing that people do. They don't care about what's in the actual body. They just see the headline. They assume they know what is, because they don't like to read. So working in a visual medium, working on camera, has been really, really interesting, because I do prefer to write. And if it was up to me, I'd be like sitting in my living room, probably writing. Writing was my dream job, but there is so much opportunity with video and with what you're able to convey that I've really, really enjoyed this process, and I've kind of sunk my teeth into the production process, and I've started to really, really like it. So I would say that it just constantly evolved, but it's kind of hit the next plateau with being able to tell stories visually.
Now, in your storytelling, you are working with BR and doing a show out here. What are some of the kind of stories that you're covering, and where are you traveling and going to do those stories? Are you mainly based US when you're doing the work, or are you traveling to Europe? And if so, what are some of those locations and stories that you're looking to cover this season?
Yeah, so with Out Here, basically we're looking to just flesh out Champions League, like the teams, the supporters, just the culture of Champions League for an American audience. So the very first piece I did was in Athens, Greece with Olympiacos. It was a very different from all the rest that we will do. We went and kind of snuck into Gate 7. It's like their infamous ultras area. I would say we probably shouldn't have snuck in, but we did. We went in there, kind of filmed it from the inside. And then, so our second one was way, way different. We actually sat down with Galatasaray in Turkey. They have a huge ultras group called Ultra Aslan. It's like, one of the, if not the biggest supporters group, ultras group in the world. They're like 25, 30 million deep. And it was one of those things where I have known for a long time about the passion Turkish fans have for this game, and it we really just wanted to flesh out how much these fans love their team and how much they care. So we went in, shot with Ultrathlon. They like fully embraced this. We went, on one of the days I went to an Ultrathlon wedding. I went to a memorial service. I got to hang out with the guy they called the race. He's like their big boss, like the head of all Ultrathlon. And I didn't realize like how important this dude is to Galatasaray supporters, because when I was walking around before the match, like we were doing some player interview, some like interviews with fans, the word got around that I had met the race, and like Galatasaray supporters were coming up to me to get pictures with me just because I had met the race. And it was just one of those things where it's like, this is next level over here. So those were the first two trips we did. Next up, I am heading actually this Sunday ahead. I'm going to do a couple interviews in England, but then we head to Ukraine to shoot with Shakhtar Donetsk. And that is going to be an interesting one because it's kind of centered around the fact that they are originally based in a war zone, in Donetsk, and their stadium actually got bombed. So they had to move. They now train in Kiev and they play in Kharkiv. Kharkiv is about 6-7 hours drive from Donetsk. So some of their supporters still drive, or a good number of their supporters will drive or take the train or whatever from Donetsk to Kharkiv to support their team. So we're going to kind of cover that whole angle of these supporters who will literally have risked life and limb and time and their everything about, they'll have changed their lives to support their team. And then after that, I believe we've got Croatia Zagreb and then RB Leipzig in Germany, and that'll end the year. And then from there, we'll kind of reevaluate once the knockout stages have been drawn, and we will figure out what stories we're going to go tell from there. But basically it's just, we want the American audience to know how rich the culture is behind all of these teams, not just the big teams, the Barcelonas, the Real Madrids, the Bayern Munichs, the Juventuses of the world. Like, everyone's heard of those teams, but not many have had an inside glimpse at like Olympiakos or Galatasaray or Croatia Zagreb or Shakhtar Donetsk, teams like that.
So I love the stories that you're covering and the clubs that you're covering. I tell people all the time, if you don't understand the true like footballing culture until you get to Europe and just experience, it's just part of the day-to-day life. And the fact that you guys are going around doing the show the way that you're doing it, I think is so cool, because it does give people a glimpse, an insight into what it really is. I feel like, sometimes it's from the Federation and it's from MLS. Sometimes I think it's just as a result of the fact that, you know, we are a country that's, you know, isolated by water on the east and the west, that there's this isolationist mentality within the United States. And then we see it, you know, in a political sense sometimes. We see it in a cultural sense sometimes. I think we definitely see it in our soccer sometimes as well, where we, you know, we think we know what that deep-rooted passion and football and culture, you know, is, and we'll turn on the TV and we'll see like a Portland or a Seattle or an Atlanta, and we're like, man, it's like we're making it. And I'm like, we're not close. Go to your like, it's just because we could point out two or three examples, right, where you know, where we see some really deep passion. A Detroit City, right, like just building some culture there in Detroit with Detroit City. And then I go, well, yeah, but that's like, you know, normal. I mean, that is the normal European, like, it's not even the crazies. It's just normal. So I love the stories that you're covering there. You mentioned something a minute ago about your coverage of the game and something that you've talked about before and that you know, that you're passionate about. And that had to do with, you know, race in the game. Could you take a moment and kind of talk through some of your thoughts on that and that subject specifically?
Yeah. Do you have anything specific in mind, or just kind of?
Well, I just wanted to kind of know what is your general view about how do we, where we are, number one, in that, aspect, but number two, how can we improve where we are, in that area?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you touched on it a little bit earlier, just the geographic divide that's in this country. And I see it especially heavily now that I travel to Europe so often. And it's, when I took the Fox job, I decided that I was living in DC at the time, and I decided I wanted to do the cross country drive from DC down I-10 route all the way across and head to LA. So I did that with my best friend, and it was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had. But it just put into perspective how big this country is and how much it doesn't really make sense that this is one country. Like, we were just driving across Texas, like 110 miles an hour. Like, people were flying by us, and we're just driving in Texas and driving and driving and driving and driving. And it's like, this is one country. I mean, this is one state. Like, it should be probably three or four countries. It's the size of three or four countries. No one in Texas cares what anyone in the rest of the country is doing, especially like when you have 100, 200, 300 acres and don't literally even see other people. This summer when I was in France, covering the World Cup, we had a weekend off. So producer and a shooter and I drove from France, from Paris to Amsterdam. It was like a 4.5 hour drive. We went through Belgium. You go through parts of Holland. You go through two or three countries. And with the European Union, like, my producer was driving and we crossed into Belgium, and I was like, "Hey man, we just crossed into Belgium." And he was so confused. He was like, "Wait, what? Do we not have to like do anything? We don't have to like, we're already here." He was just confused about the system and like how close everything was and like how interchangeable everything was. And that's like a long way to say that, number one, our country is so, so big that football wise, it's hard to get everyone on the same page. It's hard to get everyone on the same page, just period. We obviously have a big issue in this country with not just racism, with, I think, just ignorance. There's a lot of, with all the information that kind of is out in the world, there's a lot of misinformation. I don't know if you've ever read 1984, but I think it's a pretty interesting I think it's a pretty interesting allegory that we do have so much doublespeak. We have so much misinformation that I think a lot of people are just kind of angry with their situations in general. And there's a lot of kind of rhetoric around, whether it be immigration, whether it's race, whether it's poverty, just that there's a lot of hate in general. And I think because our country is so big and it's so hard to get everyone on the same page, it trickles into soccer. We see it with our national team. We have no idea how we're going to play. We have no idea where we're going to pull our players from. What kinds of players do we want? And I think just because soccer has been for so long and is right now a middle to upper middle class sport with also no real view to making money in the U.S., like, you can make okay money now. But I think there are just so, so many factors that from the outset have kind of precluded or prevented a lot of Black people from getting into the sport. And then when we do get into the sport, it has been really interesting. There's not too many of us. And I think in a long roundabout way of saying, it's just I think we don't really know exactly how we're going to handle this sport as a country overall. And then we haven't even come close to figuring out how we're going to handle minority participation in this sport. Based on the demographics of this country, our national team should be probably half or three quarters Hispanic. We should have a lot more Black people in the national team. But that's not shown because at the lowest levels of the sport, I think a lot of people are, specifically Black people, do not play because of the barrier to entry is so high with pay to play. When a lot of kids play rec and then drop out, because once you get past rec, you're paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month just to play it, select, challenge, whatever it is. And at those levels, mostly the people that are paying because they want their kids to get a college scholarship. The goal for most parents in the U.S. that have their kids playing soccer is not to make it to the national team. It's to pad the resume. It's to get a scholarship so that you can get into college easier or pay less money. So most of what we have geared to in this country is both making money and sending kids to college. So it's not ideal for producing pros. It's not ideal for pulling those who might not have the money to play the game into the game, to keep those players who do love the game and have gotten into the game in the game. It's just cost prohibitive. It's too much travel. It's all these little things. And that's even going without like cultural and social issues within the sport. Basically, there's a lot. that was a very like roundabout and convoluted way to kind of give my state of the union, but we have a lot of work is kind of the what I want to get at.
I 1,000 million gazillion percent agree with everything you just talked about. One of the things I want to kind of pick your brain on, and maybe you have some thoughts on, maybe you don't, but how do we make it more accessible and open and give opportunities to families so that it's not a matter of how much is in your bank account, but it's how much, you know, your child wants to play, being the determining factor of whether your child is playing or not. How do we provide more opportunities? You mentioned this pay to play system. I rail against it, all the time. Just to kind of give you a little background, a few years ago, I decided to start, it was almost an experiment, honestly, a single squad travel club, and it was a free to play club. So you didn't pay anything to play. We provided all of the uniforms, all of our coaches. We volunteered. We were literally like going into trailer parks and picking kids up to bring them to practice. In a squad of 25, we had 10 countries represented, in every continent except Antarctica. And this is in South Alabama. So if we can pull it off here, it can be pulled off anywhere in this country, because, you know, Alabama is not known as the most diverse state when you look at the United States. But we had kids from all backgrounds, all socioeconomic status, multiple languages, etc. And we figured out a way to do that and pay for that programming for them, to provide them opportunities, and ran that program for a couple of years. And then I had to transition out, and it eventually ended up kind of shutting down once I walked away. But that program provided opportunities for kids that were not in the system. And we did, we had, you know, a bunch of Latino kids, and kids from all backgrounds, that came and played for us. Every shade of skin color you can imagine was on the team. From the darkest to the lightest to anything. For us, it didn't matter. Like, it was just like, do you want to play? And yes. Okay. Well, let's find a spot for you. So, how do you see tackling this issue of getting beyond, a system right now that is just so addicted to, you know, charging high fees to families, and as you mentioned, it is a deterrent for a lot of people to be able to be involved, especially as they get older and want to be playing at a higher level. How do we find a path for those families that love the game, want to be in the game, but maybe don't have the bank account for the expensive pay to play system?
Yeah, I think one of the ways to do that is we have a massive rec system set up in this country that still works in a lot of ways. Like, kids can play for very cheap. I think the issue is that in those programs, we don't have good coaching. We don't really have great resources. But I think if we were able to kind of put more money into coaching, education, into making just better coaches and people who can teach the game, it wouldn't necessarily lean on kids, like parents sending their kids to go play for a select team at 8, 9, 10 years old, where you go travel around all the time. You don't need to do that at 10 years old. Like, you don't have to be on a travel team at 8, 9, 10 years old. If kids could play at a good level and get good instruction for cheap at the rec level, I honestly think it would change so, so much. Say you play at a rec level till you're 10, 11, 12, or at that level. And then, because we're starting to have more of an academy system set up, you get identified at these, say it's rec at 10, 11, 12 years old, you're still playing in this where it's good level. You're getting good coaching. You're playing regular. You're having fun. And it's about having fun. That's what it is at that age. At 10, 11, 12, you're not like, yeah, you may think you're going to be a pro, but 90% of those kids are not going to be pros. What we need is them touching the ball regularly, having fun, playing, everyone just in the game and enjoying it. And then from there, you identify the players who have something special, who will continue to play at the next level at 12 or so. And then maybe they go to an academy. And from there, the academy should be covered by the clubs themselves. And even if they go play for an intermediate club team, I think that we're not going to eliminate pay to play in this country. It's America. Capitalism is king. So we're not going to eliminate it. But if we can, number one, get some of the kids that cannot afford to do that, keep them in a system where they can learn the game, have fun, and not spend exorbitant amounts of money, and then identify them. So, hey, you have something special. We're going to bring you to the next level. Say you live in D.C. At 12 years old, you're going to come to the D.C. United Academy because we saw you playing for like Loudoun Rec. And you're going to come to D.C. United Academy. You're going to train with us. We're going to pay for your training. We're going to get you to training. We're going to either bus you in, whatever it is. And that kind of precludes, it basically eliminates part of a big part of the issue, where is that it's that like between like 9 and 13, where you're paying for like travel soccer in the hopes that maybe you'll go play for a good club team. And then in the hopes you'll get picked up by an academy, in the hopes you'll then go to college or play for a club, ideally a professional club. But I think kind of that like 8 to 12 to 13 age range, if we could kind of build up our rec and lower level programs where it's both state and government subsidized. I'm not actually sure if rec is like government subsidized, but basically the lower cost, if we can improve coaching at those levels. I think coaching is one of the biggest things. We just don't have many good coaches. We don't have places where kids can learn the game, unless it's from like a parent who, like, often it's like an immigrant parent who grew up with the sport and they teach their kid how to play. But if we can get better coaching and better coaching education and lower the barriers for coaching education also, because it's crazily expensive to get coaching licenses. Like, even if you want to be a coach and you're not attached to a club, it's almost impossible to afford those fees. And to be attached to a club, you have to have been a coach. So it's like it's a catch 22 situation. So I think improving coaching at rec levels, coaching education, would have a huge effect.
I love your thoughts there and agree. I really feel like, I don't think it was a nefarious attempt here a couple decades ago. I really think there's a lot of well-meaning people thinking, if we take it more serious, if we do this, we can improve soccer in this country. And so that kind of built into this monster that it is now in terms of the pay to play and the expenses, that weren't around, 30 years ago. But I think what we missed and what has happened as a side result of that is a lot of cities and a lot of towns around this country have programs that, you know, as you're calling them, rec programs, community-based programs, whatever terminology you want to use, have kind of gotten forgotten. And it's like, well, you know, you can't really be a serious soccer player and play in those. You have to come over here and play in this. And, you know, I always kind of laugh when I hear that, because, you know, going back to reference, you know, where I'm from, I mean, you take a kid playing American football and they're playing for their local town team, and they're playing against their other local town teams all in, you know, in a county league set up. And eventually those kids are finding their way into the NFL. You know, they're not paying thousands upon thousands of dollars to get there. You know, I think we've in an effort to try to improve the soccer development and programming, we've lost sight of the actual soccer piece of this. And it has become too reliant on making money rather than the programming itself. I do think there's ways to do that and make a living for sure, from a coaching and whatever standpoint. But to me, it's definitely gotten out of balance across the country. I don't know that you're going to fully ever put the genie back in the bottle, but I do think there's some things we could do in terms of having an open system, creating more opportunities for clubs to become professional, to have multiple layers and depth of levels of that, so that some of those clubs could then, you know, operate in a way a European club operates, and really invest their own resources into producing players and getting rewarded for it. You know, would also, I think, over time, make a systemic impact on pay to play and access and opportunity for kids, regardless of their socioeconomic status. So, look, Aaron, I really appreciate you coming on the show, spending time with us, sharing your thoughts. We were literally all over the world in the conversation, and I love it. Definitely want to have you back on again soon to dive into some more topics. But how can people get connected with you if they're not already connected? And if they're not, shame on them, with you on social media, follow your stories, follow your work, etc.
Yeah. So I am at AYYY_West, AE West on Instagram, Twitter. That's where you'll see just about all of my musings. And BR at BR Football is where all of my work is. Instagram, Twitter, you can find it there, the YouTube. That's where everything I'm doing with BR will be, but personally, AYYY_West. And I really appreciate you having me on, man. This is a great conversation.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on. Your better half has been on the show a couple times, and she was instrumental in helping getting us connected to have you on. I appreciate her doing that, and really appreciate you coming on the show. My last question for you as we head out is, what is it like being married to a better soccer player?
Oh, it's great, man. It's amazing to have someone that, like, hey, I want to go kick around. I can just go kick around with my wife. And I can play competitive one-on-one literally anytime. It's one of the coolest things in the world. Yeah.
Well, I love watching those videos when you guys post them. It's certainly fun to watch, and I'm sure there's a lot of trash talking back and forth in those moments too, which always makes it even more fun. So, look, appreciate you coming on the show. Thanks for coming on. We will be following your work, and really look forward to having you on again in the future.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That is you too. That is Aaron West with BR Football. And again, you can catch his work at BR Football or at A West. So check him out online. We really appreciate it. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll see everybody again on Monday.